Hey guys, it's Emma.
And Shannon.
And welcome back to our podcast, She's an Engineer.
In this episode, we have another history special. So today we will be talking about the history of women in medicine.
So first, we're going to go into some current demographics on women in medicine, primarily just physicians. So last year, in 2022, it was reported that around 37% of U.S. physicians are female, which I think is higher than the percentage of U.S. engineers that are female, with Washington, D.C. having the highest share of female physicians in the country, which is interesting. And in comparison, in 1950, around 70 years ago, there were only around 6% of U.S. physicians that were female. So it's definitely grown. I think both as a field, medicine as a field has grown, but also women's contribution to medicine has also grown as the years have progressed. Also in 2007, it was at 28.3%. And in 2020, it was 36.3%, according to the AAMC's Physician Specialty Data Reports. So it's actually grown quite a bit in the past, I would say, 15 years as well. I think it's increased about 10%.
So that's pretty significant, because that was in our lifetime. When we were growing up, a lot more women were going into the field.
About every 2 to 3 years, it has jumped around 2%, which I think is pretty significant. It also shows that more medical schools are accepting more females into medical school. More females are probably applying into medical school. And just in general, more females are finishing medical school. What the AAMC is saying right now is that the cause of this steady increase in the growth in female physicians is a direct result of the steady increase in the number of female medical students. So the annual report on medical school enrollment actually showed that in 2019 marked the first time that the majority of U.S. medical school students, which was 50.5%, were women. So women outweighed men in medical schools in the U.S. specifically, and women also represented 52.5% of the applicants. So more women are obviously applying, and so more women are getting accepted into medical school. And then as these increasing number of female medical students graduate, the percentage of female physicians in the workforce should also rise. And although women as a whole have been more involved in medicine, there's also, I think, quite a big difference in the specialties that women choose versus the specialties that there are more men in. So some specialties still remain pretty male dominated, while other specialties are now very much women dominated. And I think that's also shown in engineering. So I think we talked about it. I think in electrical engineering, like computer engineering, it's still very like male dominated, whereas in some of the other engineering fields, it is a higher percentage of women in the workforce. So the specialties with the highest percentages of women are primarily focused on children and women. In pediatrics specifically, it's 64.3% of U.S. physicians that are female. In obstetrics and gynecology, it's 58.9% of female physicians. And in child and adolescent psychiatry, which is actually not a huge field and it definitely needs more people, it's 54% of physicians that are female. And then in neonatal perinatal medicine, it's 52.8% that are female. So that would be the study of like neonates, so like infants and when infants are still inside the mother. Or not infants, I guess fetuses are inside the mother. There are also specialties in which women still remain a significant minority, like urology, where the percentage is still only 9.5%, pulmonary disease, in which the percentage is 12.3%, and then surgical specialties tend to have less females, like general surgery has 22% females, and orthopedic surgery only has 5.8% females.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Well, it's great that the field is really growing for women, and I hope to see it continue to increase 1 to 2% each year.
Yes.
So, transitioning to the history of women in medicine, we are first going to talk about ancient times. And one of the earliest known women in medicine, according to historical records, is Metrodora, also known as Cleopatra Metrodora. She was of Egyptian origin and lived around the 7th century AD in Greece. In addition to being an accomplished gynecologist, midwife, and innovative surgeon, Metrodora wrote several books. Her notable books were On the Uterus, Abdomen and Kidneys, and On Diseases and Cures of Women, in which she explained the particulars of the diseases which commonly afflict women. Another of her influential contemporaries in ancient Greece was Aspasia in the 4th century AD. Metrodora and Aspasia climbed ranks of the medical field by performing surgeries such as operation for uterine hemorrhoids, varicose veins, and cosmetic surgeries. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Merit Ptah is known as the first female doctor who was the royal court's chief physician in 2700 BCE in the Egyptian dynasty. Pesachet was another woman known as Lady Overseer of Female Physicians in the early dynastic period in Egypt around 2500 BCE. She was cited as the first female doctor by name. A lot of women in medicine in the ancient world were left out of official records, even when the rest of the data and correspondence is well kept. There are records of several women who practiced medicine by impersonating men. One such story is of Agnodice. She was the first female physician or midwife in ancient Greece in the 14th century BCE. She practiced medicine disguised as a man, but was later found out for it. Her female patients protested her trial and she was acquitted. Following her trial, the law which barred women from practicing medicine in ancient Greece was also revoked.
Wow, she was definitely a revolutionary, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I can't imagine, like, not even being able to participate in the profession. But I guess that's what happened before. That's why right now it's, like, growing, you know? Mm-hmm. So next we're going to talk about some of the female physicians that practiced in the medieval times. So in early 12th century Germany, Hildegard was a nun and healer who founded two convents. She took spiritual and physical care of everyone coming to the monasteries, as it was the safe haven for the sick and downtrodden. And then once she gained autonomy after heading the convent at Rupertsburg, she produced many scientific and medical texts. So the texts are Liber Simplicis Medicinae, which is the Book of Simple Medicine. This is, I think, in Latin. And the Liber Compositae Medicinae, which is a Book of Compound Medicine. And then also, while in Italy, a small town called Salerno was a bustling center for learning medicine. So Trotula, who was a female physician in Salerno in the 11th or 12th century, was actually known as the first female professor of medicine. She wrote an extremely essential book called On the Treatments for Women, and this book was received well and circulated widely throughout Europe. Because at that time, they also believed that, I think, treating women was completely different than treating men. Like, they thought we were, like, completely separate, even though now we know that many of those things are not the case, but there are obviously still some differences between treating men and women. Yes. But, you know, those advances are really important because if not, then, you know, who would have focused on treating women? I feel like female physicians know females the best, you know? So So if anyone's going to advocate for their female patients, it's going to be female physicians. Mm-hmm. So another milestone for women in medicine was achieved by Dorothea Bucca. And in 1390, she succeeded her father as the professor of medicine at the University of Bologna. She held this esteemed station for the next 40 years. Wow. That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then transitioning to the 1700s and beyond, we're going to talk about a few women. And as the practice of medicine was beginning to professionalize during this period, numerous institutions for medical training were established, as a result of which women made significant progress in various medical professions such as midwifery and allied health professionals. One such illustrious career was that of Martha Ballard. She was an accomplished American midwife who cultivated a diary of entries of 816 childbirths, and it was transcribed from the year 1785 to 1812. Insane. That's a lot of childbirths that she helped with. She definitely knew her stuff.
Exactly.
And then in 1849, the glass ceiling was shattered by the famed Elizabeth Blackwell. She graduated from Geneva Medical College to be America's first female doctor. And that was no easy feat. Her presence at an all-male medical college was not well received. And a few years after her graduation, she established a dispensary in New York to treat poor women and children. In 1857, the dispensary diminished function, and Elizabeth founded a hospital along with her sisters called the New York Infirmary for Indigent Women and Children. At this hospital, she hired other women in positions of power, such as physicians and faculty. Foundations were laid for several women's medical colleges in the 19th century, such as New England Female Medical College in Boston and in 1848, and Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania in 1850. In 1868, Elizabeth Blackwell established her medical college attached to her New York infirmary, the Women's Medical College of the New York Infirmary.
Also, if you want to learn more about Elizabeth Blackwell, we've actually dived into her life in one of our Remarkable Women in STEM episodes. So if you want to, go check that out if you're interested in more. So another notable woman in medicine is Sophia Jex Blake, who campaigned for women's admission into medical colleges. So for the first time in Britain in 1869, she and seven other women started their medical training at the University of Edinburgh. However, their degrees were revoked following protests, and they continued their studies in other European universities, which is crazy. Like, I can't believe, or I can't even imagine going through medical school and going through the rigors of all those programs just to not be able to receive your degree because you are a female, and then mm-hmm. needing to go to a separate university and, I guess, redo the whole degree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 And then in an essay written by her, Sophia Jex Blake, she notes that even when women contain an instinct to care for the debilitated, it is men who have dominated the profession of medicine, which we still see today. She declared a need for a fair field and no favors. So in 1874, she established the London School of Medicine for Women. And then in 1886, she advanced to establish the Edinburgh School of Medicine for Women.
Wow. And although women as a whole were advancing in the field of medicine, the progress had been lagging for women of color. In 1864, Rebecca Lee Crumpler graduated from the New England Female Medical College, and she became the first female African-American to obtain her MD. Her publication, Book of Medical Discourses, is also the first medical text written by an African-American. Despite the relentless racism she received, she continued to treat the freed slaves after the Civil War ended.
Wow, that is very impressive. Like, all mm-hmm. of these women are very impressive. And then in 1889, Susan LaFleche Picot was the first Native American woman to become a doctor, which was even 35 years before Native Americans were even recognized as U.S. citizens. She oversaw the medical care on her Omaha reservation, which covered some 1,350 square miles, which you can imagine was a lot of patients for her to treat.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And then moving to the 1900s, in 1953, Dr. Virginia Apgar devised the first tool to scientifically assess a neonate's health risks and need for potentially life-saving observation. The 10-point Apgar score is still considered the gold standard for determining the health of a newborn. She was also the first woman to head an academic department and hold a full professorship at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. In 1959, she became a senior executive with the National Foundation March of Dimes, where she generated public support and funds for research on birth defects. When she graduated from the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University in 1933, Apgar hoped to pursue surgery. A mentor discouraged her, so she decided to study anesthesiology instead and became the first director of Columbia Presbyterian's Hospital's new division of anesthesiology 5 years later in 1938. Former U.S. Surgeon General Julius Richmond once said that Apgar had done more to improve the health of mothers, babies, and unborn infants than anyone else in the 20th century.
Yes, we've definitely talked about her a lot in medical school as well. And fun fact, Virginia Apgar is from New Jersey. So if anyone was interested. Okay, moving on. In 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, MD, published the pivotal book On Death and Dying, which revolutionized the treatment and understanding of dying patients. So she was a Swiss-American psychiatrist, and she was an advocate for better treatment of the mentally ill and the terminally ill, and is also very well known for defining the five stages of grief. So her work was a catalyst for modern hospice care, living wills, and the death with dignity movement, which I think is super important. And this is also a shout out or a plug for making sure that you have your living will done as well as your plan for your end of life care.
Yes.
Yes.
And then in 1990, Antonia Novello, MD, became the first woman and first Hispanic to serve as U.S. Surgeon General. Novello's career spanned academia, private practice, and the U.S. Public Health Service, where she became a leader in AIDS research. As Surgeon General, Novello focused on women with AIDS and neonatal transmission of HIV, encouraged Hispanic and Latino Americans to participate in health issues, and raised national awareness about domestic violence, underage drinking, and alcohol abuse.
Very cool. Yeah, and the last woman that we're going to talk about is Nancy W. Dickey, MD. So in 1998, she became the first female president of the American Medical Association. She had previously served as the first female chairperson of the American Medical Association's Board of Trustees, and she was board certified in family practice. A notable contribution that she made to the American Medical Association was that she developed the AMA Patient Bill of Rights. Yeah.
And I think that sums up all the women we wanted to talk about in today's episode. I know we're only able to touch on a few, but there are thousands and thousands of more women in medicine who are just as important and who have paved the way for female doctors in today's age.
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to add?
No, but I'm very thankful for all these women who have paved the way for us, basically, who have allowed us to pursue the specialties that we would like to pursue, just like the females in engineering that paved the way for us.
Yes, exactly. Hopefully, yeah. We've made a lot of work so far, but there's still a lot of work to do in the field. And I think that sums up our episode for today. So thanks for listening. We hope you learned something. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.